It's Monday, the 18th of August. This is your BizNews briefing. I'm Bronwyn Nielsen. Here's what's making news across South Africa and beyond. The national dialogue already in tatters. More on the SANDF blunder in Iran, outcome of Trump-Putin meeting in Alaska, and Rossie Erasmus on Saturday's wallaby hiding. Cyril Ramaphosa officially opened the first national convention of the National Dialogue in Tshwane, describing it as a pivotal moment for the country. He told delegates this wasn't about politics, it was about people. Ramaphosa said every voice in South Africa matters and the dialogue should spark a million conversations across the depth and breadth of South Africa. He urged citizens to use the platform to tackle tough issues like poverty, inequality, and gender-based violence.
The National Dialogue is a call to debate and to discuss, but it is also much more than that. More importantly, the National Dialogue is a call to action. It is a call to all South Africans to seize this moment for change and progress. And this we cannot do when we are sitting on the sidelines. This we cannot do when we do not want to be part of this conversation. And this we cannot do when we sit on the sidelines and just criticize. We need to be inside the tent rather than being outside of the tent. And we also need to have one tent. We do not need another tent where other conversations will take place. This is the real tent.
But the convention quickly turned chaotic despite the president's hopeful message. Things didn't go quite as smoothly. Paul Mashatile walked out unexpectedly, leaving delegates stunned and angry. He later did return to the convention. Outside, protesters voiced frustrations, saying they felt excluded from the process. Some only found out about the event through the media coverage. Inside, emotions ran high. One delegate collapsed during a heated session, and others demanded answers on corruption, crime, and inequality.
In our groups that you are going to put us in, will the entire cabinet that we see here be part of the plenary? Or are you guys going to leave us to discuss on our own and we come up with our own solutions, which then means there's no point of us having this discussion because you will not hear what we are saying. We are the foot soldiers. We are on the ground. All of you here have bodyguards. We don't have bodyguards. We had a colleague who came here from 3 a.m. in the morning.
All right.
We are
Thank
foot
you so
soldiers.
Much.
We know what's happening on the ground. And if you say it's a national dialogue for us, you can't shut us down. It's sad that you are here because 2026 elections are coming. So you're trying to buy our silence.
All right. Thank you so much. Let's give that a hand. And then I'm just going to pause here because this is what we want. This is the dialogue we have been called to do. We are in plenary. We're not going to go into dialogue now because I'm going to give you the reason.
This is not a dialogue. I have a question, ma'am.
I have a question.
No, I have a question before anybody.
Excuse me.
No, excuse me. Excuse me. First, you need to read the pedagogy of the oppressed. This process must be dialogical. It must not be one-sided. You don't come to talk down on us here. Number one. Number two, we are four members of the Rastafari community here. We are all bundled up into one theme. We represent a nation of Rastafari, of 3 million South African Rastafarians. We can't go under one theme. We have issues that cut across everything that needs to be dialogued here. You don't decide for us. Nothing for us without us. Simple as that. And for the last time, this is a dialogue. Spend more time listening to us than telling us what to do.
Political economist Moletsi Mbeki weighed in with a harsh critique. He said the convention had become an ANC-driven event, not a genuine civil society initiative, with seven legacy foundations, including those of Thabo Mbeki, Steve Biko, and Desmond Tutu, pulling out. Mbeki questioned the point of gathering 1,000 people just to talk about procedures. His comments reflect growing doubts about whether the dialogue can deliver any change.
This is actually an ANC event rather than an event of civil society, because it seems that only the president of the ANC and the president of the country wants this to go ahead, notwithstanding that the people who have been working on trying for the past year or two to try and make the national dialogue happen, which were the legacy foundations, now that they have withdrawn, President Ramaphosa says, actually, this is not about conversation. It's not about dialogue. It's not substantive. So the national convention is just about procedures. So how do you get 1,000 people to come all the way to Johannesburg just to talk about procedures? To me, it seems like a waste of those people's time and a waste of money.
Last week, SANDF Chief General Rudzani Mapwanya visited Iran and pledged solidarity with the Islamic Republic, including support for its stance on Gaza. The visit sparked backlash, with critics saying that the general's remarks were out of line. South Africa's Foreign Affairs Department has quickly distanced itself, saying the comments do not reflect official policy. Presidential spokesperson Vincent Magwenya has also added to the fray, confirming that President Ramaphosa had no idea the general was going to Iran. He said the trip was not sanctioned and called it ill-advised, especially given South Africa's efforts to rebuild ties with the United States. Magwenya reminded the public that foreign policy is strictly the responsibility of the president and Durko.
On Iran and the general's visit, did the president know that the general was visiting Iran? Neither did he sanction that visit. The general's sort of administrative process for travel approval starts and ends with the minister, as much as the president is the appointing authority and the commander-in-chief. He does not get involved in supervising the general's travel. That process sits with the minister. So the president did not know. Is there concern? Yes, there is a concern. At this period of heightened geopolitical tensions, as well as conflict in the Middle East, one can say the visit was ill-advised. And more so, the expectation is that the general should have been a lot more circumspect with the comments he makes, which delve into the area of foreign policy that only the president, as well as the Department of International Relations, are responsible for, and does not fall in the purview of the officers. We are in a process of managing a very delicate exercise of, one, resetting diplomatic relations with the United States, resetting political relations with the U.S., but more importantly, balancing the trade relationship in such a manner that that trade relationship is mutually beneficial. And therefore, it is indeed not helpful.
Meanwhile, Washington's patience with Pretoria is wearing thin. Senior fellow Joshua Mazurvi of the Hudson Institute warns that the general's visit may have dealt a fresh blow to US-SA relations. Here's Mazurvi in conversation with Alec Hogg, direct from Washington.
You know, the news raced around the WhatsApp chat groups and other communication platforms. And I think in some ways, people in Washington almost just shake their head when in despair, maybe when this happens, because I'm not sure people are even particularly surprised anymore that the rhetoric from the South African government about wanting to have better relations with the United States, wanting a reset, does not align with the actual actions of very senior people within the South African government, including, in this case, General Mapwanya. So I think it reinforces this idea within Washington that Pretoria is not going to change on this, and the African National Congress as well. They're not going to change. They're not going to undertake the types of substantive actions and reforms that are necessary to actually repair the relationship with the United States.
This is where the unthinkable happened. They just came here and took his car.
No. I sold it to them. What's this?
It's crime scene tape. Did they pay you at least?
Within 15 minutes, money was in my account.
Were you happy with the number they brought you?
I got almost the same price as what I paid for the car. Everything was easy, everything was painless.
Well, there you have it, South Africa. With We Buy Cars, you won't come short. I'll tell you really.
1.93.
We Buy Cars, the easiest way to sell your car by far.
At Sun Exchange, we make going solar simple, profitable, and completely risk-free. Join over 100 satisfied South African customers already enjoying the benefits of risk-free solar. Start saving today. Visit sunexchange.com and join the solar revolution.
Bloomberg's Anne-Marie Hordern discusses President Trump's and Russian President Putin's meeting and the press conference both leaders held, which saw each one give statements without discussing any details on agreements reached. Anne-Marie speaks with Joe Matteo on the late edition of Bloomberg's Balance of Power.
Well, a lot of people were caught off guard because, of course, this was supposed to be a press conference. But what we had in the end was just two leaders giving statements. President Putin's honestly was prepared remarks, and he did, though, signal that an agreement had taken place, that they agreed to something. President Trump immediately said there is no deal until there's a deal. Basically, nothing is agreed until everything is agreed. And then he put a lot of weight on the phone conversations he's going to have subsequently leaving Anchorage, and that is going to be with European leaders, leaders of NATO, and, of course, with President Volodymyr Zelensky. I think it is way too soon to jump to conclusions that we know really what the end game here was, because we just don't have enough details. Clearly, there was no full agreement. There's no cessation of hostilities. And we didn't even get past the 3x3 bilateral meeting with the foreign policy aides of both these leaders to expand into other discussions, which would have been a loss for Putin, because, of course, he viewed this meeting in terms of restarting bilateral relationship with Washington to discuss New START, which, of course, expires in February of next year, to also discuss economic cooperation, rare earths in the Arctic, we're just south of the Arctic Circle, where we are now, and pressing for his economy are those sanctions. So we cannot jump to conclusions right now, but clearly this is the start of a much longer process. In the meantime, President Putin, though, was given, the red carpet as he landed in the United States for the first time, Joe, in a decade.
Israel plans to expand settlements into an area of the West Bank that would effectively bisect the enclave, a move its finance minister, Bezalel Smotrich, who also oversees settlements within Israel's defense ministry, said buries the idea of a Palestinian state. Bloomberg's Dan Williams reports.
Dan, how significant is this plan, especially considering a lot of the rhetoric that we've been hearing about any sort of expansion over the past few weeks?
Good morning. The significance is mainly in the timing. We're a month away from the annual UN General Assembly in New York. On the sidelines of that, or perhaps not on the sidelines, it could be a central issue. A number of Western countries are poised to recognize Palestinian statehood. This would buck the convention going back decades. The Palestinian statehood embraced by the international community would have to come about as a result of negotiations with Israel. Those Western countries say they're doing this, or they might do this, in order to pressure Israel to cease fire in the Gaza Strip. There's much consternation about the Palestinian civilian toll in Gaza. So Israel's response yesterday, namely by its far-right finance minister, was to announce building in this wedge area of the West Bank, an area that international that players have been watching for 20 years and effectively prevented Israel or convinced Israel to abstain from building in. So what we have here is a declaration of intent. Indeed, the Israeli minister said this would, quote, bury the idea of a Palestinian state. And the United States, unlike previous administrations, the current administration appears to be on side with this. They're in no rush to condemn this or try to curb Israeli measures. So what we have is a tussle over the idea of Palestinian statehood now being played out on the ground.
Tesla robot rival Unitree shone in the Beijing Games. Hangzhou-based Unitree Robotics caught the spotlight at a robotics competition in Beijing, boosting its reputation as a national champion for China's ambitions in developing AI and humanoids. Bloomberg's Annabelle Droulas reports.
You've been also tracking, no pun intended here. They were on the track yesterday, or on the weekend. Humanoid robots,
the robots,
right?
Yeah.
And didn't Unitree come out?
Unitree came out in front
victorious,
in the 1500 meter race.
Yeah.
And they did it in like under 7 minutes. I mean, it's really crazy amount of time. Unitree, of course, is seen as sort of the leader in the humanoid robot space in China, or a leader in it. This was a game that, I mean, you're seeing this vision here. You can see it kind of goes through different events that there were. So you had football, for instance. There was table tennis. I think there was sort of 26 different medals up for grabs. But I think a lot of that focus really was on that main race that Unitree took the top prize. And they had another top prize in a separate running race. So, I mean,
I love that the humans have to run with the robots, though.
Well, that's the thing as well to note, actually, because at a lot of the events, it is worth pointing out that they were still being controlled by humans. It's not fully autonomous, but yeah, I mean, boxing. We can never have enough robot boxing.
No.
Yeah. So anyway, that happened in Beijing. It was a 3-day event over the weekend.
Yeah, 6:35 for the 1500.
Could you do that?
I believe.
That's easy.
Yeah. That's slightly slower than my half marathon pace, actually. Yeah.
Just a little bit.
Because a mile is 1600, right? It's 1.6.
But
anyway.
In a brutally honest post-match press conference, Springbok head coach Rassie Erasmus expressed deep disappointment following South Africa's 38-22 loss to the Wallabies at Ellis Park on Saturday. After racing to a 22-0 lead, the Springboks collapsed under pressure, conceding 38 unanswered points and surrendering their top spot in the world rugby rankings. Erasmus described the performance as one of the most embarrassing of his coaching career, admitting that the team was outplayed in most departments, including the lineouts and breakdowns. He emphasized that the coaching staff must take responsibility for tactical errors and poor game management. The loss marked Australia's first win at Ellis Park in 63 years and only their second ever at the venue. Erasmus acknowledged the Wallabies' resilience and criticised his own side's lack of fight.
Yeah, I must be honest. That's probably one of the most embarrassing press conferences I've done in a while. And not because we were awful, but they were really good. And I don't want to put the old cliche out there, credit to them. You know, they were good, but we made them better with our performance. You know, to be 20-0 up, we did the same against Italy. You know, 27-3 up, and then we let teams back in. You know, we can find excuses there, but at the end of the day, they gutted it out. You know, they had a few injuries on Skelton, and Pete went off, and you know, we had one or two injuries, but. Yes, we gave them one or two soft tries with an intercept here, and we were almost scoring, and then they scored from a pass from Andre. So, but overall, they were just better than us on the day in most departments. We didn't scrum them. They beat us in the lineouts. For the first 25 minutes, I thought we were really good at the breakdown. But after that, when Sia got injured and Mark, we had to go for HIA. They bullied us at the breakdown. Yeah, so I could just sit there and say, listen, they beat us in most departments. We as coaches got it terribly wrong. And we have to look first at ourselves before we point fingers at the players. But we know from now till next Saturday we're going to take a lot of flack. But when we take the credit when we're doing well, and then I almost take the flack when we're doing badly, and I'm not saying it with a smile because I'm happy. I'm saying it with a smile because that's the reality of rugby. And we're very disappointed, and we are feeling bad for our supporters, and we're feeling bad for our players, and overall for what we produced today on the field. We are very disappointed. Interesting thing is the longer the game went on, you know, they're supposed to struggle at altitude, but it just shows what Joe is building there, and we were always nervous about that, that he's getting a bunch of guys to really believe in each other. And they got stronger as the game went on, and then we made a few errors. So, yes, next week's team internally was announced, but we'll review tonight. We won't go to bed really early. The saddest thing is, you know, 5 points for them. We didn't even fight back to take the bonus point away, you know. So currently we're on 0 points, they're on five. We'll see what happens between New Zealand and Argentina. I can butter this up to sound cool and respectful, but we did just really dog shit on the day.
That brings us to the end of today's BizNews briefing. We'll be back tomorrow with more context on the local and global front. Thanks as always for joining us.